This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's Olly.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone. I'm Ikrisha Gupta-Chima, your host for the New Books Network. Today, I'm very pleased to welcome Matthew Hall, Jeff Hearn, and Ruth Lewis, who will talk to us about their super cool book, Digital Gender Sexual Violations, Violence, Technologies, Motivations, which was published by Routledge in October 2022. Matthew Hall hasn't been able to join us at the start of this conversation, but he might join us in the middle. So once he joins us, then we'll be able to introduce him and ask him a couple of questions as well. But till then, we are just going to move forward with Jeff and Ruth and ask them a couple of questions. Thank you so much for joining me today. Could you please tell our audience about yourself and your work a little bit?
Okay, well, I'm Jeff. I'm Jeff Hearn. I'm sitting in Helsinki. And I guess I could say that I've worked on issues around violence, particularly gender-related violence and sexual violence for a very long time. And I think maybe from the late 70s, as long as that. And I suppose I should also say formally, I'm actually linked to three universities, which is a bit weird, but that's the fact. So one is in Helsinki, at Hanken School of Economics. Another one is in Sweden called Örebro University in the middle of Sweden. And then in the UK, where I'm from originally, University of Huddersfield in the north of England. Okay, is that all right for a start?
Yes. Thank you. Ruth, could you introduce yourself, please?
Sure. So I'm Ruth Lewis, and I'm sitting in just outside Newcastle in the northeast of England, and I'm an associate professor at Northumbria University.
Thank you so much. So could you tell us a little bit about the genesis of this book? How did you start working on it? How did you all come together for the idea?
Should I begin again, Ruth, or not? I mean, how to keep this short? As I said, I mean, I've been working on violence a long time and on sort of what you might call technological or digital issues from around the late 90s. But then Matthew Hall and I met actually in a taxi in Iceland about 5-6 years ago. And Matthew said, oh, would you like to work together on what was then, you could say colloquially, called revenge pornography? It's a really bad term. But then we actually did decide to use that term and explain it for an earlier book 5-6 years ago. And then we continued being in touch. And then, I don't know, should I pass over to you, Ruth, at this point?
Sure,
what happened next? Maybe by these sort of chance encounters that have happened in different places.
So I've been working on issues around violence against women and gender-based violence since the early 90s. And I think, Jeff, you and I did meet in Manchester at some point in the 80s or 90s.
Yeah, I think so. Maybe a couple of times on some panels. Yeah, I think so.
Yes. And then the three of us met in Helsinki at a conference there about 3 years ago, pre-COVID, when, in the days when you could actually go to conferences and see each other. And at the conference, then Jeff and Matthew were doing a presentation that was in part about upskirting. And at the time, I was also doing some work about upskirting, and there weren't many people doing that work. So it was just great to make that connection. And we started working on a number of things, including a project about upskirting. And then I was really delighted when the two of you invited me to join with you in doing a second edition of your book, Revenge Pornography. And that's how we all started out on the book, really.
Yeah, although I think if I jump in, I wouldn't say it's a second edition, actually, in some ways. It's actually a very different book, and not least the title is very different as well. And I think we struggled for a long time about how the term revenge pornography is used in the media a lot, and used in newspapers and culturally. But it's a as I said earlier, it's a really bad term, actually, for all sorts of reasons. And we try and recognise that. So I guess what we've been doing is looking at a wider, a broader range of different violences and violations and abuses, both in other work and also in this particular book. Yeah.
Cool, thank you. And now that you have mentioned it, would you also elaborate a little bit about like why you think the term revenge pornography is problematic and how people should approach it?
Do you want to go, Ruth, or should I? I don't mind.
Well, why don't you? Because it's the title that you've used in your previous book. And
I think the first thing, well, I mean, I think there are several arguments. And I think one is you're just saying that it's a term that became popular, you might say, and fairly well used, I guess, around, I don't know exactly, but maybe 10 years ago, I'm not sure. But I mean, one of the problems is that by using the word pornography, it, if you like, pornographizes what has been done. I mean, it puts it into that frame, and a lot of online digital abuse or abuse of partners or ex-partners is not about that, and it's actually redefining something in a very sort of inappropriate way. And of course, again, the word revenge, and one could discuss, and of course, some of these activities, and of course they're mainly by men. I mean, you know, not 100% perhaps, but I don't know, maybe 90%, I don't know. Some are about revenge and some are about other kinds of motivation. And then there's also an argument that, a different argument coming from a different direction, that all or most, much pornography is a kind of revenge on women, or certain kinds of pornography. There are many kinds of pornography, of course. So I think whenever we've used it, at least in recent years, we've tried to put it in inverted commas and then perhaps explain how there are. The problem is, and we discussed this in the book quite a bit, terminology is quite a problem, actually, in this area, without getting too pedantic in itself. Because, I mean, there are lots of terms like, you know, technologically facilitated intimate partner abuse. I mean, that could be one phrase, but that's five words, isn't it, I think. So it's not, and then, you know, or, you know, online partner or ex-partner violation, or and so on. One have all sorts of different terms. And I guess one of the things is that they're not always so easy to say quickly, but we are talking about different kinds of violations. Yeah. Not all to do with partners or ex-partners, actually, but I guess we'll come to that a bit later. Yeah. Do you want to add to that, Ruth? I mean,
I suppose the only other thing to say is that the term revenge can be read as victim blaming as well, because revenge suggests that there's been some offence or some behaviour to take offence at that the perpetrators are responding to, and it suggests some sort of justification. So for that and all the reasons that Jeff has said, then that term is problematic, because we're talking about, you know, abuse, violation, violence, rather than something which can be consensual, like pornography.
Right.
One of the things that, and this is looking mainly at how at least some men online sort of describe what they're doing in this kind of activity, there is very often a kind of reversal going on where that they see themselves as a kind of victim to justify and legitimate those kinds of abuses and violence. So that is a kind of, you could call it like an inversion of some kind, I mean, arguably,
Right, yeah. Thanks for explaining that. So how would you describe this book to the audience?
Well, we are, we're trying to give a kind of up-to-date examination of a range of different forms of digital violations. So we talk in detail about some particular forms, but before that we try to sort of position these forms of violation in their social context and to theorise them, to consider issues around terminology, like Jeff has mentioned, to think also about how we measure, how we research these issues. So we look at the kind of sort of theoretical explanations of how, what purpose digital gender sexual violations serve and how we might understand them. You know, we use this term digital gender sexual violations, which I don't think is used more widely elsewhere, and we break down what we mean by each of those parts and why this terminology is an alternative to other terms like revenge pornography or image-based pornography or online abuse, you know, all of which have some value. But this term digital gender sexual violations, we think is a really useful kind of umbrella term for all of those different types. And so then we look at in detail at some empirical data about some different sorts of digital gender sexual violation. So we look at online abuse of feminists, upskirting, so-called revenge pornography, as well as a range of others. And here we're drawing on empirical data from research that we've done together or in various combinations of the three of us. And we're providing information both from the a victimological perspective, so victims' experiences, and examining perpetrators and how they engage. So, for example, the chapter on upskirting looks at how perpetrators on dedicated websites for upskirting, how they engage with each other about upskirting. So it tells us a lot about upskirting as a phenomenon, but also a lot about men's what we call homosociality and their desire for kind of kudos and status with each other. So we're looking empirically, we're looking from a you know, both perspective of perpetrators and of victims. And then the final section is about some wider implications. We look a bit at some of the sort of policy, socio-legal implications of this form of digital violation. You know, we don't, it's not a book about policies and what to do about these violations, how to eradicate them from our worlds, but we make some suggestions about kind of effective interventions. So that is a brief overview. Jeff, feel free to...
Yeah, I think that was really good, actually, yeah. I mean, I'll just say a word about the title again, if I may. Yeah, I mean, we use the word digital rather than online. I think it's to get up, well, there are several reasons again, but it's partly to get away from the idea that these violations are only about, say, somebody sending an abusive email or sending images around by iPhones. I mean, obviously, that's really important. That's not the only possibility. And increasingly, actually, the technology is perhaps moving away from that. in terms of things like virtual reality and so on, which we discuss briefly in the book, not primarily. And then this middle bit that sort of, we've had sort of debates on this amongst the three of us, and we use this term gender hyphen sexual as like one word. And this actually goes back to a long debate. In fact, I remember Liz Stanley and Sue Wise wrote about this, I think in the maybe late 70s, early 80s, about how, you know, how does one sometimes see something as gendered or sexual or both, if you understand drawing a line is a bit difficult and impossible in some situations. And then we use the word violation. I mean, that's, again, one could debate this long, but, I mean, sometimes violence is used in very particular ways. Obviously, physical violence is what comes to mind usually for many people, but also sometimes violence is used in relation to intention to harm, yeah, intending to harm, which is a bit different talking about the experience of violation, which may or may not be intended, if that makes sense. So, I mean, yeah, we go through this kind of thing in the beginning of the book and then hopefully follow it through with some of the examples that Ruth mentioned and then some of the sort of broader implications towards the end.
Yeah, definitely. I do agree on the terminology just because I was working on a book and that was like one of the, you know, biggest things that I had to contest with. It's like, how do you be specific, but also at the same time, like be comprehensive in a way, like when you refer to these ideas. So I really appreciated that you paid a lot of attention to just kind of like clarifying the terms that you're using and what do you mean specifically by those terms. So you mentioned that you have been working on violence, gender, sexual violence, pornography for some time. Which changes have you observed in the trends for digital gender, sexual violence and the way media and scholars of different genders or sexual orientations have treated these trends over time?
That's a big question, isn't it?
That is a big question.
It's a really big question, that one. It's the hard one. Yeah, I don't know.
Shall I make a start?
Yeah, you're very welcome to make a start.
Because I think it's a really good question and really topical, because I'll start by talking about my teaching experience. So I've been teaching this subject for, 30 years. And I really notice that young people today, they come into the classroom with a much greater awareness and more advanced level of understanding about the issue. So when I used to teach, I taught a module called Intimate Partner Violence for decades. And when I used to teach it, then the first few weeks would be spent trying to convince the students that it was indeed a gendered phenomenon, and that the perpetrators were mostly men and the victims were mostly women. And there'd be a lot of back and forth about this throughout. You know, there'd be quite a lot of resistance about that. So this is kind of late 1990s onwards. Whereas now, in the last few years, and it's probably kind of in the post-Me Too era, I notice that students who come to the classroom, they get it. They don't need persuasion about that. You know, they often want to say, yes, but what about when women are violent, or what about men's experiences? It's important to pay attention to that too. But they understand it as a gendered phenomenon. And they also have an understanding of it as a much wider phenomenon. So late 1990s, I think there was still a kind of public perception, for example, of intimate partner violence as being about physical violence. It's some awareness of emotional abuse as well. But I think this term coercive control, introduced by Evan Stark, has really resonated. And certainly my students have got an understanding of all kinds of gender-based violence as being about power and control. And again, they don't need convincing of that. They get it. So I feel really cheered by that, actually. You know, writing the book meant that we were kind of immersed in some pretty grim material a lot of the time. But every now and again, you know, I take my head out and think, no, things are changing, because look at how new generations of young people kind of approach the issue. But I think that there are still pressures to de-gender discussions about the phenomenon. And I think this happens probably more on a policy and a government level. I don't think it happens so much in scholarship. And I think this is where scholarship's got a really important role to keep demonstrating with the use of evidence that the phenomenon is gendered and that we therefore need to take a gendered approach to looking at violence against women and girls, that we're not going to fix the problem unless we address the key feature of it, which is ideas about the proper roles and behaviours of men and of women. So we're not going to address it unless we've got, to my mind, a feminist understanding. I think there are also in the media and probably in government and policy, you see more kind of neoliberal understandings of gender-based violence or violence against women, which see it as an individual aberration, which see it as, you know, the solution as being about liberating individual women or empowering them with, you know, whatever the latest gadget is to try to ward off, you know, an abusive man, you know, something you put over your drink or an alarm or, you know, double thickness knickers or, you know, all kinds of things that are introduced as if they're a remedy for the problem. And again, I think scholars and activists have just got a huge role to play here to keep showing that this phenomenon is structural. It's not an individual problem. It's not about bad apples. It's not about an aberrant individuals. It's about the gender regime and how we build and generate ideas about the proper role and behaviours and dynamics between men and women. So I think, you know, I've certainly seen changes. I know you will have too, Jeff. And I think if I can just finish on one other interesting development that's really capturing my attention, which is work by abolitionist feminists, talking about anti-carceral feminism, which I've got a lot of time for, although I'm not completely convinced about because I'm not certain about the alternatives. But one of the things that I notice is that when I was doing my PhD in the late 90s, these were exactly the debates that I was engaging with. You know, they were talked about slightly differently, but they were debates about whether we can ever have faith in the justice system for providing justice when it comes to men's violence against women. So it feels in some ways as if we've come not quite full circle, because each time you come back to a debate, it's a new generation frames it in a slightly different way. But it does make me wish in some ways that scholars who are looking at that work now would also look at some of the older work that rehearsed these debates that are so important and so difficult to resolve. Yes, yeah, so yeah. They're my observations, Jeff. Yeah. About you. What changes have you seen?
If I have a go, I mean, I think why this question, and I'm thinking whilst you were speaking, Ruth, and obviously, I mean, I think why this question is very complicated is that it's about lots of different things. I mean, it's partly about, if you like, obviously what is going on in society, and I would also say different societies, and I think that's been one greater awareness. I mean, this perhaps sounds so obvious to say that I think a lot of debates in the, say, 70s and 80s were very national, very nationally located. So there's what's going on in society, then there's, you know, then there's the whole sort of how that is represented or responded to media and government, as you mentioned, Ruth, and then there's scholarship, and then there's last, but probably should be first, activism. And there are changes in all of those, and they kind of interconnect with each other. I mean, the first thing I was involved in, I think this is right, was around sexual harassment, actually, with my dear late colleague Wendy Parkin in the late 70s, early 80s. That's what we were looking at in workplaces. And then sort of looking at child abuse, actually, and then men's violence against what we called known women, with again, dear colleague Joanna Hanmer and others. And so in a sense, you know, the focus of actually studies can change for individual scholars. But also, I think there's something that's changed. I mean, maybe this is now misremembering, but you know, when I think back to the 80s or even early 90s, I think there was more sort of attempt to separate both different kinds of violence from each other. You know, there was sort of the psychologist doing something over there and the sociologist doing something over there or somewhere else. And there was a kind of narrower attempt to look at different kinds of violence separately. And I think, and also perhaps to look at, you know, say psychological explanations like versus cultural or cultural studies explanations or political or even economic. But I think now there's more coming together of realizing both how different kinds of violence connect with each other, and also without being too sort of over positive, you might say, I think that there is more work that is amongst scholars and activists as well, of course, looking across what you might call, well, as a shorthand, different sort of disciplinary or positions, you might say. I mean, I think there was more segmentation. I don't know if you agree with that, Ruth, but that's one sort of observation. And then, of course, the other thing is that, I mean, in terms of this focus of this particular book, obviously, I mean, I don't know. I mean, technology is not new. And actually, that's one thing we've actually written about a little bit and talked about amongst ourselves. I mean, technology, and that's partly one little argument, or big argument, why actually the term technological facilitated is not perfect either. Because, I mean, you know, guns are technology and knives are technology and, you know, pens are technology. But, I mean, of course, there has been a huge change in terms of digital technologies. I mean, one can date it perhaps from the, I don't know, middle 90s or something like that. So the forms have changed as well. And of course, that's also affected issues around pornography. I mean, I'm not a specialist researcher on pornography. I've done some work. You can't avoid it. But I have tried to avoid some kinds of pornography research, actually. But of course, commercial pornography industry has changed fantastically compared, say, well, historically, you can go back to the 19th century or centuries ago. But of course, the technology, such as it is now, has transformed that. So the old-fashioned way of doing technology, and also doing, whether you want to call it prostitution or sex work, that's a whole debate in itself, has also changed, obviously, massively, as well as, I mean, I do recall in the late 90s coming across the work of Gail Dines, very important research in the US, which was cataloguing these encyclopedic resources online about where men could, let's say, buy women or buy women's bodies. Yeah, I mean, so that was a sort of encyclopedic sort of resource, you might say, which was obviously much more accessible than was the case in, say, even the 70s or 80s, relying on different kinds of written or telephone technologies. Yeah. Anyway, so I think there's more of these interconnections, plus also this transnational, this international connections have become very important. Sorry, Ruth, I saw you waving your hand.
about transnational connections, then I think, you know, we, like many other researchers, have now a much more intersectional approach than was adopted in the 70s, 80s, 90s. I mean, I must say, I think this is overstated sometimes because there was,
yes, I agree.
Particularly activism and practice was very often intersectional. You know, it was lesbian feminists of different ethnicities. It was working class and middle class people working together, people of marginalized ethnic identities and white women working together, you know, across in solidarity across these different sort of social divisions to set up a refuge or to have a campaign against sexual harassment in the workplace or whatever it might be. And I think, you know, I think you might agree, Jeff, that the textbooks tell the story now that the second wave feminism was all about white middle class straight women. And it is just simply not true. You know, there was intersectional work going on. It wasn't called that because, of course, we didn't have that term then. But I think that, you know, it's a great thing that we have a much more intersectional awareness of how these different systems of oppression work together with patriarchy to prop each other up and to reinforce each other.
Well, it was gender, race, class, Angela Davis and many others.
Thank you so much for that answer. You already talked a little about intersectionality and interdisciplinarity when we talk about these issues. So one thing that I was interested in was the multimodal approach that you have taken in the book. So could you speak a little bit about the significance of a multimodal approach for this kind of study or other studies for digital gender sexual violations or violence?
Shall I try briefly, Ruth? Have a go? Yeah, it's funny you used the term multimodal. I don't know whether we use that in the book. I'm not sure. Maybe we do, maybe we don't. But I think it certainly fits, I think, because I think from the beginning, actually, I think that approach is particularly important at the beginning and end of the book, actually, because the middle is more like particular examples, as was said, like upskirting and others. I think this goes back to a bit what Issa was trying to say, or we're both trying to say, is that it's very difficult to reduce, you know, particular kinds of digital sexual, gender sexual violation to one particular approach, you know, like psychological, cultural, political, and so on. And this actually creates problems, actually. Like, say, legal, you know, to try and reduce this to a legal problem is actually very difficult. And this is something that I think a lot of lawyers have been struggling with, actually. So these kinds of activities or these kinds of violences or violations, you know, I mean, they operate in lots of different ways at the same time. I mean, they operate sometimes immediately, you know, instantly. You can send an abusive email to the other side of the world. But they also operate in a totally different way sometimes, where something is done that is not known about for 5 years, or not sometimes never known about by the person or persons affected, or is known about by their friends and neighbours and or work colleagues, but not by themselves immediately. So, I mean, that's just one example of this immediacy, but also this sort of, you could say, time delay or even never knowing. And then, I mean, one could look at these phenomena, and I think it's important to, and I don't know whether you agree with this exactly, Ruth. I mean, although we've talked about this a lot, I mean, under this umbrella, there are lots of different kinds of phenomena as well, or activities. So one's got to be a bit, not exactly open-minded, that's the wrong word, but sort of flexible in thinking about what kind of activity are we talking about. Is it, you know, directed at someone who has been or is, you know, a partner or a best friend, or is it something that is spread to, let's say, other men in general? And Ruth mentioned just briefly about upskirting, how some of the ways of writing about that are actually very much men talking to other men, or men showing other men pictures or videos that they think are so-called, and this might sound a bit weird, good quality, in inverted commas. So again, you know, one sort of thinking about, well, some of this, I mean, upskirting, to use that as an example, clearly that is partly about objectifying or abusing or violating women with or without their knowledge, actually. But it's also got something in that example is equally important, which is about men's relationship to men, almost like regardless of women, where women or girls, and also can be the currency, if you like, for communication in a sort of a way that sometimes might be thought about as what goes on, like sort of so-called banter, verbal banter can become sort of converted, inverted commas, into sort of images, if that makes sense. I'm not stretching the metaphor too much. So anyway, this is just some examples of how having what you nicely call multimodal or a sort of multidimensional and intersectional and thinking about this also as being both immediate and local and in a national context, but also increasingly transnational as well. That's some thoughts, yeah.
And just to note too that it raises difficulties about how you research this phenomenon or these phenomena, because it almost feels that anything you write about it is out of date pretty soon after you've written it. I probably shouldn't say this about our book, which we obviously want people to read and not think of as out of date, but the different forms, techniques of violation are changing and developing all the time. We talk about some emerging ones about, like Jeff mentioned, using AI for so-called deep fake pornography, amongst others. But things are changing and developing all the time. I mean, it's one of the things about that's really noticeable about abuse of men's use of the digital world is that they are exploiting technology and the digital world, you know, with tremendous kind of knowledge and flexibility and creativity. And it's therefore quite difficult to keep up with that. And it also means that it's quite hard to get longitudinal data on things because the early research about online abuse used, a certain range of terminologies which 10 years later were kind of out of date. So research 10 years later used a different range of terminology. So it's then quite difficult to compare, for example, prevalence rates in those two different points of time 10 years apart, because they're exploring slightly different things, or perhaps at the earlier point sending so-called dick pics, sending abusive images wasn't so common. 10 years later, it's really common. So it wasn't explored earlier on. So it presents some methodological challenges as well as kind of more sort of conceptual challenges, as Jeff has suggested.
Perhaps just one quick thing to sort of add to that, which perhaps we haven't mentioned enough because it's perhaps so obvious, which is the basic issue of talking about things being in real life and or virtual and being online or offline. I mean, maybe this is so obvious, perhaps, but I mean, those very words, I mean, everyone knows what they mean, I think, in real life and virtual, but they're both and online and offline, but what goes on is more complex than that. And of course, what happens virtually or online, if you want to call that, of course, obviously has major physical bodily effects. I know this perhaps is too obvious, but that is a sort of major theme, I think, running through the book and through these debates, which actually is complicated both like legally, for instance, and also analytically and politically as well,
I think it is really important to mention that actually, Jeff, even though it seems so obvious, because it explains partly why, for example, police have been so slow to respond to online abuse, because there was kind of a sense of, well, it's just don't read it. Just don't go on those websites, just come off social media. There wasn't a recognition of the very kind of embodied, visceral impact that digital violations can have, as well as an impact on one's freedom and safety, because of course there is, they are not neat, discrete categories. The online bleeds into the offline. Many abusive partners will use both online and offline forms of abuse. They're not separate activities by any means.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you so much for the comprehensive answer. And you already kind of like led to this question now. One thing that I was really intrigued by was the chapter that discusses online abuse of feminists. So I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about that to our audience.
Sure. Well, to start with, and we must acknowledge the work of Mike Rowe and Claire Wiper, who I did the original research with on that project. Although, my thinking on the subject has really benefited from Jeff and Matthew's, from collaborating with Jeff and Matthew. So we Mike, Claire and I did a small research project, which was the first national victim survey of people who engage in feminism and their experiences of online abuse. So it was in the relatively early days of online abuse, but it was inspired by seeing the abuse that women generally were exposed to, but feminists seemed to be particularly picked out for it. And of course, women and feminist women aren't the only people to experience abuse. Men experience, you know, plenty of abuse online as well. But what's distinct is that when women experience abuse, it very quickly targets their gender, targets their bodies, becomes sexualized, and uses kind of gendered patriarchal tropes. So the nature of the abuse directed at women and directed at men is different. So we wanted to explore more about that. So the survey asked people about their own experiences, and we got loads of data about both the kind of what you might call the everyday abuses. You know, some people saying, oh, it happens every day, it's so normal, I hardly notice it any longer. Others said, it occurs occasionally and it's shocking. Others said, it was the volume of abuse that they'd experienced that was really significant. So receiving thousands of messages from hundreds or thousands of people, mostly men and boys, the sense of an onslaught was really significant. So one thing that we really wanted to explore was this idea of a continuum of violence, because up until that point, the media had talked only really about the sort of so-called sledgehammer events, what Betsy Stanker calls the sledgehammer events. So the cases, the Gamergate, Caroline Criado Perez in the UK, you know, people who'd been subjected to really high volume abuse. But we knew too that there was a much more sort of, in inverted commas, mundane, routine kind of form of abuse that some women were receiving, much less voluminous abuse, but it was still part of their life. It was almost like the wallpaper of their life online. So we gathered information about the nature of it and the kind of key features about, you know, as I say, the abuse very quickly becomes sexualized, becomes gendered. In some cases, it's also racialized, and it refers to people's sexuality, i.e., you know, it's homophobic abuse as well. So it's not misogyny on its own. So we did this survey, and we had intended to do a whole bunch of interviews, but in fact, we got such rich qualitative data from the surveys, we needed to do a smaller sample of interviews, but we did do some interviews with women too. And so these were all women who engaged in feminist debate online. We had the survey was open not just to women, but we had a very small number of men and non-binary people complete the survey. So in terms of the analysis, we focused on women's experiences. And they were women who engaged in debate sometimes, you know, for several hours a day, sometimes kind of an hour a week kind of thing. One of the things that was a clear finding was that the platform on which they experienced most abuse was Twitter. And I think that has real implications given the changes at Twitter now and, less opportunity to police abusive content throws up real risks, I think, for people using Twitter. And we also looked at the impact, because at that time there was a lot of talk about online abuse being designed to silence women. And clearly it does silence some women. But what we found from the survey was that many of the women felt galvanized to engage further in feminist politics because they felt that, you know, the experience of online abuse did nothing but prove the need for a feminist debate online and more than just a debate. So that was a useful finding, that it doesn't simply silence women and feminists. It also leads to more solidarity online, more activism online, more feminist debate online between women and with men too. And then finally, we also talk in that chapter about the function of online abuse of feminists. And put simply, we can interpret the function as being about a desire to exclude women from the online world. And Sia Pera, in fact, talks, I think, draws really useful parallels with the witch hunts of the 16th and 17th century. And she says that there the witch hunts served a purpose to get women to conform to the new institutions or the ongoing institutions in society at a time of change from feudalism to capitalism. And she draws a parallel that now we're moving from capitalism to techno-capitalism. And this online abuse of feminists is about preventing feminists and women more generally from having access to technological resources, from having a role to play in the means of production of the techno-capitalism. So it can be seen as a way to exclude women, particularly women who don't conform to patriarchal norms, i.e. women who speak out, women who express feminist politics, women who don't conform to gendered expectations. But one thing just finally is that we can assume that the motivation is misogynistic, and it's probably hard to deny that. But it's likely to be more complex than that. And in fact, one of the respondents who's quoted in the chapter noted that there might be other power dynamics at play in some of the abuse directed at feminists online. And they refer to the conviction of, I think, the first conviction in the UK of people for online abuse. And she reflects that, you know, they did not look to be powerful people. One was a woman, one was a man. They did not look as if they had high status, you know, from what we can tell. So there might well be other aspects of power at play, you know, in terms of class, in terms of public status, in terms of authority. So misogyny is a feature of the explanation of online abuse against feminists, but it might not be the only one. And again, we need a kind of intersectional approach to understanding why that kind of abuse happens online. So, sorry, that's maybe quite a long-winded answer, but I don't know if it addresses what you are particularly interested in.
No, definitely. Thanks for providing a comprehensive answer to that. Would you like to add anything to that, Jeff?
No, that's fine. No, I'll maybe one thing. I think now there's quite a lot of work on journalism. Journalists, actually, yeah, particularly in some countries being targeted.
Yeah, for sure, definitely. Yes, and since you already mentioned like other different countries, and you already kind of like talked a little bit about how these conversations are more transnational now, as opposed to the maybe like 70s, 80s, 90s, when these conversations are more national. I was wondering if you could speak a little more about the issues of gender and sexual violence in a transnational context.
Shall I have a short go? Yeah, well, I think I said earlier that now these debates cannot really be looked only locally or nationally. I think that's become pretty obvious, really. And also, I think when one talks about transnational, I mean, that can mean different things in itself. I mean, it can simply mean sending a message across borders, if you like, across national borders. Or it can also mean some sort of change in to what extent people are thinking about these issues or in a sort of in a local or national context, or picking up on different techniques of abuse from different parts of the world and then re-employing them in somewhere else. And what you might call sort of creating either as transnational, well, I use the word culture as a shorthand, either for different kinds of abuse, but also for different kinds of activism against abuse as well. So it works sort of two ways at least. And then one's got like who's doing the abuse in, as individuals or groups, and how that, you know, how that links to the sort of who runs the platforms, you know, corporately, or, you know, who actually, and they are often, well, that they are virtually always some kind of transnational organization or business of some kind. And then there's the problem, again, going back to sort of transnational legal issues, which obviously are very difficult. I mean, I think these issues are being picked up to some extent within the European Union, which is a pretty, you know, large transnational organization, but it's far from straightforward. So, I mean, that's just, I think all those things are going on and they're changing. And I mean, neither of us, or none of the three of us are lawyers, although we've actually had contact with lawyers or legal, those dealing with this issue in the UK particularly, and they're struggling with this, as, and not least how to actually build in issues of gender and sexuality and racialization into what often is easiest presented as sort of neutral inverted commas law. So, I mean, I think these are some of the things which now cannot be avoided, which, again, it's going back, it's perhaps one difference or apparent difference to situations in the 70s and 80s when there was less of these kinds of abuses. Yeah, that's some points. Yeah, I should say, I mean, Matthew and I have actually written on this separately. We've also written quite a lot of different things in different permutations, like on upskirting and on transnational specifically. And Ruth has written with colleagues, as you said, on the abuse of feminists. So there's quite a lot of overlapping patterns, you might say, going on here. But the transnational thing is part of it. And I think also it links to what is happening with different kinds of, you could call it emerging abuses, which you mentioned already around, you know, AI and virtual reality and deep fakes and various combinations and synthetic realities and so on and so forth. And that's actually, we do discuss this a bit in the book, but actually it's a shame Matthew's not here, actually, Matthew Hall, because I would say Matthew is the most expert on that area. And that's something the three of us are working on now, in terms of this more, what you might call immersive or virtual, even sort of limitless abuse, where you don't actually need the bodies of women, or you don't need the bodies of particular women, perhaps I should say, to create those kind of violating environments. And that takes you into some different issues, actually, which we could talk about, but I hope you get I'm sure you know what I mean by this. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. All right, thank you. Would you like to add anything to that, Ruth?
No, that's okay, great.
Awesome. Okay, so you already mentioned some of these issues and mentioned how Matthew would have been a better person to talk about it, but I'm just going to pose the question anyway. Can you speak a little bit about how acts of violence like deepfake pornography, spy camming, cyber flashing, etc., work across different postee permutations that you mention in your book? Like you talk about, you know, like men to men, men against women.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Do you want to comment, Ruth, on this? Or shall I have a go?
I think I'd rather you did.
Okay. Okay. Well, I mean, this is it's a repeating some comments from half an hour ago, I guess. I mean, it's about thinking about this as a very broad area that's changing, and there are different forms, you might say, and some are very direct, like somebody sends, like, you know, at a certain time and place, an abusive email to somebody else. Or they may record something that they send to somebody else, or they may record it and then not send it and send it later, or they may take images and reuse them without consent. So there's many, many permutations here. And that can be done individually, or it can be done collectively, if you like, both collectively in the doing or collectively in the receiving. And it can be instant, or it can be delayed, the repeat, and it can, I mean, it's very difficult to remove certain things totally from the internet. It is possible, but that's not so easily. So things stay there, or they can be fleeting, or they can be ambiguous. Sorry, this is just a series of possibilities. But then one moves Well, we've talked a bit about upskirting, and perhaps we should just say a word on that again, is that we looked at various platforms or discussion forums, you might call them. It sounds a bit strange thing to say, where men share their images and videos they've recorded. And actually, how can I put it? It's a way of gaining status in that community. And we ended up, well, one of the things we used, which was a bit controversial, a bit risky, we used the term polite misogyny. This might sound very strange, because the relations, they were obviously, as I said earlier, objectifying women and violating women. But actually, some of the conversation was very polite between the men. So it was misogynistic, but it was very polite. And it was like giving praise to each other sometimes for, you know, very great skill, so to speak, in doing this. And, of course, you can make comparisons with other kinds of homosocial spaces, whether they're more or less polite or more or less rude. I mean, one could talk about this in, say, I don't know, so-called locker room talk, you know, and so on. So, I mean, that's something which is definitely relevant, but a bit different to the way sometimes these things are seen. And then when one gets into this more, yeah, virtual reality area, there's many possibilities, as you know. And I mean, there's a creation of a different reality that, say, may use parts of, and I use the word parts deliberately, of women or to create that reality. But actually, once that's done, that can be reproduced or replicated and elaborated on just like any other. And of course, this is also not just visual. And increasingly, we're talking here about multi-sensory possibilities, including touch or haptic, to use the jargon. And as I say, that's something we're working on now, or gradually working on, which is these possibilities of multi-sensory virtual realities that are creating abusive and creating the conditions for further abuse with or without actual women's bodies. So that's going quite a long way, really, from where one began, and quite a long way from some of the things that have been done, historically. Let's call it pre-these technologies. Maybe I'll leave it at that. Yeah, that's some. I mean, now, one last thing we haven't mentioned, which I think is also really important, and again, we're working on this, the three of us, with another colleague, Charlotte Niemistö, in Hanken in Finland, which is about location. And so, I mean, when one talks about these things, it's often thought about in terms of partners, ex-partners, friends, acquaintances, etc. But also there's the added complication of, does this relate to, let's say, workplaces specifically, maybe colleagues or ex-colleagues? Does it relate to, say, sports clubs or leisure clubs or religious organisations? I mean, so the kind of other locations that are perhaps a bit different to sort of people's domestic or personal sexual life or their friendship groups, I think, I think are very, very important. And they complicate these issues even more in all sorts of ways that we could talk about for hours, actually, because we're writing on that as well. How does this relate if, for example, one person in a work team experiencing this, and then do the other colleagues of that person, in a sense, try and support that person? And does that affect them as kind of secondary abuse or reactivation in some cases? Just carry on working as if nothing, in order to support the person, they carry on working regardless in a so-called normal, inverted commas, way. So these location issues or organisation issues are very, very important. Sorry, Ruth.
And they throw up, really important questions about who has responsibilities here in terms of employers, particularly, which is perhaps kind of one of the last domains, I think, to really sort of explore the responsibilities that there are amongst employers to address gender-based violence. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's not just governments or public policy. It's institutions, organizations, universities, employers, as you say, and so on and so forth. Yeah, religious organizations. Yeah.
Cool, thank you. Next question that I was curious about is, how did you co-write a book? There are, you know, like three of you, then you have other people who are contributing to, you know, like, for example, you mentioned that you had contributors for the chapter about abuse against feminists. And I was just curious about, like, how do you manage that? Like, what does that look like?
Well, thank God for email and Teams, which is mostly how we did it, isn't it? You know, after the initial first meeting, then there was lots of email communication, lots of Teams meetings, lots of sharing of chapters and ideas and so on. And it worked really seamlessly, I think. I hope it reads seamlessly, because, you know, it's written by three people with slightly different writing styles, and we didn't spend a lot of time kind of trying to find a kind of a shared writing style. But we would each take the lead on one aspect of the book, of a chapter or a section of a chapter, and then merge together the contributions, and then, you know, review it back and forth over email, having conversations along the way, you know, so using kind of the comments sidebar on Word documents was invaluable. And, you know, big thanks and big acknowledgement to Matthew, who led the whole process and kept us in line, kept us in check. And I must say that, you know, writing with people where you've obviously got a shared kind of approach and a shared goal, but also where writing with people who are really reliable and who, you know, there are various stages, and one of us would have something going on and somebody else would step in, and it just felt like great teamwork in that respect, really. So despite the fact that we were dealing with really, really grim material, you know, there was real pleasure in the writing process itself, I think.
Nice, that sounds great. Yes.
Can I add to that? Yeah, well, I'd say, yeah, I think there's like a history as well. You know, I mean, yeah, this isn't just something over the last couple of years. We didn't meet at all, actually, during the writing, apart from this initial meeting in Helsinki was by chance, and we just talked, I think, for an hour or so, but not about this book, actually. I don't think so, no. I mean, I would say that, yeah, putting aside the material, it's been very enjoyable to work together with Ruth and Matthew. Absolutely. It's been, I wouldn't say easy, but it's been pleasant despite the unpleasant material. But, I mean, perhaps the other thing which I don't think we've said, I mean, perhaps it's fair to say we do have different... well, we've got different ideas, of course, yeah, and we have different locations, including geographically. Matthew actually works in Egypt, actually. So Matthew's in Egypt, Ruth is in UK, and I'm in Finland. And I think Finland and Egypt are the same time zone, actually, which helps at least slightly. But Matthew's background is, I mean, his background at least is psychology, or particularly, especially discourse or discursive psychology. My background's a bit of a mixture. I don't know. It's sort of geography originally, and sociology and social policy, gender studies, and even organisations. Do you want to say, can I say what your background is, Ruth, or would you want to talk about
it? I'd say mine is sociology with a bit of criminology and sociolegal
gender studies as well.
There was, you know, if you had a Venn diagram of the three of us, then there would be some nice overlap, but also some distinct areas, which also I think really helps on a writing project, doesn't it? That, you know, you're bringing different things to the project.
But we all went through everything in the book. More or less led on each chapter, more or less, but then everybody went through everything and amended or disagreed or whatever. Yeah, so I think it is I think it was sort of consensual eventually. It wasn't always initially in the first round, but yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I think so, more or less. Maybe that explains the multimodalness as a way of dealing with that issue, maybe.
Yeah, definitely. The book does read quite seamlessly, and seems like you make a wonderful interdisciplinary team, which also helps a lot. So my last question for you is, how do you suggest academics and readers approach this book?
Mm-hmm. Should I start?
Yeah, go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah. Well, I think there's probably quite a few things, but the two things occur to me sort of straight up. And this might be a bit idealistic, but I would like people to approach it in some sort of dialogue, actually. Because, I mean, maybe this goes back to the multimodal again, actually, because there are different angles on this, without repeating, you know, I've said earlier, and different people may be drawn to different angles, like, you know, the legal side, the cultural side, the psychological side. So I think I'd be interested in people reading this a bit in dialogue and, you know, taking or disagreeing or agreeing or developing some angles or a combination of angles. That's one thing. I think the other thing, I mean, which is a bit different, is there are different parts to the book, actually. I mean, so some of it is about methodology and some of it is about changing forms of online or violation, et cetera, et cetera. And some it's about legal issues. So some people might just be interested in different parts more than other parts. I mean, you know, if one's interested, yeah. And that could be also relevant, I suppose, to like if you're teaching in this area with students or whatever, you know, one chapter methodology might be of interest as an example of how not to do things, which wouldn't necessarily be something that some people who are more interested in law would go into. I mean, that's perhaps a trivial example, a bad example, but yeah, that there are two things that come to mind, at least. I'd like people to debate more around the relations, actually, of sex, gender, and sexuality, actually, personally. I think that is still not discussed. Of course, it's been discussed hugely. Of course it has. But I think that relation between sex, gender, and sexuality, and whether those words are really quite good enough, actually. Mm. This might sound a bit weird, but I think, that's some thoughts.
Yes, I think it's very much about what do these forms of digital violations tell us about the gender sexual order. You know, so it's not... it is multi-layered, I suppose. I was going to say it's not just about the technologies of violations, but it is clearly about that. But it's also about how they are sexed and gendered and what they tell us about the gendered sexual order of this moment in time as well. So I hope people will also read it as an account of the phenomenon at this point in time, which in 10 years time will be different, but I hope it stands as a useful kind of record of where we were at this point in time.
Great, thank you so much, and thanks a lot for this wonderful conversation about your book, Digital Gender Sexual Violations, Violence, Technologies, Motivations. I look forward to interacting with more of your work in the future.